A reading from the Gospel, Mark chapter 1, verses 21 to 28. Jesus and his followers went into Capernaum. Immediately on the Sabbath, Jesus entered the synagogue and started teaching. The people were amazed by his teaching, for he was teaching them with authority, not like the legal experts. Suddenly, there in the synagogue, a person with an evil spirit screamed, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are. You are the Holy One from God." "Silence," Jesus said, speaking harshly to the demon. "Come out of him." The unclean spirit shook him and screamed. Then it came out. Everyone was shaken and questioned among themselves, "What's this? A new teaching with authority. He even commands unclean spirits, and they obey him." Right away, the news about him spread throughout the entire region of Galilee. The word of God for the people of God.
So I want to confess right off that I find this hard. In September, I was asked by Boots to preach to you, and I preached my first and only Zoom sermon, and I hated it. I felt like I was talking in a tunnel, seeing only myself and only hearing my voice. And that's not the experience I want in preaching with you. And so today I'm going to try something different, but I'm not really very comfortable in it. And so when you're in that situation, the best thing to do is to pray. And so I ask you to join me. Oh Lord, let the meditations of my heart and the words of my mouth be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Amen. If you were alive 50 years ago, some of you probably were, some of you probably weren't, but if you were, you just might have been in a car. Perhaps it was Sunday morning and you were on your way to church. 50 years ago, that wouldn't have been me, but you might have been there, and you might have had your radio on, and you just might have heard a catchy tune with a lively beat, but that had very somber lyrics. That would, of course, have been Bad Moon Rising by Creedence Clearwater Revival. Pay attention to some of the lyrics. "I see a bad moon rising." You probably boomed that out and everyone was looking at you and thinking you were crazy, but you boomed it out. "I see trouble on the way. I see earthquakes and lightning. I see bad times today. Don't go around tonight. Well, it's bound to take your life. There's a bad moon on the rise. I hear hurricanes a-blowing. I hear the end is coming soon. I fear rivers overflowing. I hear a voice of rage and ruin. Hope you got your things together. Hope you are quite prepared to die. Looks like we're in for nasty weather. One eye is taken for an eye." Now, I know I've been to enough meetings of Presbyterians to know that Presbyterians like their enthusiasm stayed. And so for those of you who don't think that CCR is actually church music, I tried to enlist Elliot in singing it for us, but he turned me down. Well, if you think it's not church music, then I have something else for you. William Butler Yeats, to be precise, "The Second Coming." Listen. "Turning and turning in wider gyre, the falcon cannot hear the Faulkner. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dim tide is loosed everywhere. The ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all convictions, and the worst are full of passionate intensity." Now it ends that with an image of a statue, an entity in the desert, a body made of a line and the face of a person. That certainly symbolizes oppression, violence, empire. And he says that that beach is slousing toward Bethlehem to be born. That's how I feel today. I turn to these things because I want to give you a sense of what my frame of mind was as I approached the lectionary passage today. It's pretty much down in doom. I see really a bad moon rising. I see a hideous entity slouching toward Bethlehem to be born. The center, I don't know if it'll herd, and everybody lacks conviction, but the most intense and passionate. So I had that kind of mindset when I came to this passage. Now, I'm sure when you heard it, a traditional interpretation and understanding came to mind. It's a pretty simple one. We turn in liberal churches, we turn demons into severe personality disorders. Jesus heals them, and they heal them back into community. And when they get back into community, everything is made whole, and we are whole again. And that's somewhat impartially true. I mean, I believe that there's nothing wrong with that interpretation, but it doesn't square very much with the mindset that I brought to this passage. And so I want to go through it again, this time with a little bit more commentary. So Jesus and his followers enter Capernaum. He has been baptized. He has gone out into the wilderness, been tempted. He has called his first two disciples, Simon Peter and Andrew. They're in the water, catch these nets. And then he goes to James and John. They have a boat. They're fishing too. Now, what this indicates is that Simon Peter and Andrew were destitute, severely destitute. And John and James were kind of average destitute, because fishing was to catch fish to dry and to sell and export to Rome. That's where the source was. Capernaum is a village slightly below on the northern coast of the Sea of Galilee, but slightly below the major trading route, which exported goods and resources out to the network of Roman rulers throughout the Mediterranean. So when you hear Capernaum, you should hear a gathering of destitute people. That it was barely surviving. So Jesus entered this destitute village, and then immediately, right away, goes into the synagogue. And there he starts to teach. And people respond to that teaching with amazement. Now, this amazement has the kind of sense of wonder, that astonishment, that we haven't heard this stuff. It's good news to our ears. And they respond by saying that he teaches with authority. Now, what in the world does it mean to teach with authority? Does it mean, do you say it in a loud voice? Do you say it from a throne? Do you say it from a established institution? Are you a judge? Are you a political leader? What makes it authority? And if you look at the actual word, it has something to do with the capability of enabling. Empowerment, ability to enable the things that you want to do. And so Jesus' message is somehow enabling people to do things that they haven't previously thought they could do. He then comes and finds a person with an evil spirit. And as I said, evil spirit is usually taken as a metaphor for severe personality disorder. In this particular case, I want us to focus that this evil spirit, when this evil spirit spoke, it spoke through this person's mouth. It gave expression through this person's face. It did the nonviolent communication through this person's body. And so it's really one unit. We, when we hear evil spirit, we tend to separate out the person and the evil spirit. But we encounter that person as a whole, as one unit. And what I think it's tried to communicate, here is a person in the grips of a very evil mood. And I think that's how you have to understand it now. This person is gripped by a grim outlook. And it's not only grim, it is violent and destructive toward this person and toward others. And so Jesus comes, and right away, this person screams at him, "What do you have to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us?" And I want to save that question for a little later, but then goes on to say, "I know who you are, I can see. Because you spoke with authority and because you taught in this way, I know that you come from the Holy One." And then Jesus says something that silence is what he says, but it has the connotation of muzzling him. And then he tells the spirit to come out. And the image here actually is that he vomits the spirits out. He goes into a convulsion and vomits that spirit out. And then the spirit does everything but obey Jesus, which it says the spirit did. The spirit rants and raves and throws him down and takes off. And then the people are shaken. It's a different form of amazement. This time it's an amazement that's laced with fear. They are shaken. They don't know what this means, but they understand that it has authority that enables them and takes them perhaps to a place they can't foresee. And then his reputation grows and spreads throughout Galilee. Now, if you take the features of that thing, it fits right in with the traditional interpretation that this person has a personality disorder, it's cleansed, and he's healed back into a community. Except for that little section that's right in the center, which is these two verses, these two questions. What do you have to do with us? Have you come to destroy us? And they don't quite fit in to the rest of the framework. Well, I mean, why put those things in? This story is in Luke. It's not in Matthew. Why would you begin a gospel, as both Luke and Mark do, right at the beginning with this healing and exorcism? I mean, it's pretty pedestrian. You could have, you know, dressed it up some with having some pigs run over a cliff, or maybe you have a bit more dramatic setting, or maybe you even do a bit more, like raise someone from the dead or something. Why would you begin this gospel with this particular, rather flat kind of exorcism? And I think it has something to do with that question that kind of gets passed over as, well, had to say something, so let's put something in the unclean spirit's mouth. But why put this? What do you have to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Now, the actual Greek is, what do we have common with you? And that is, in fact, the ultimate political question, because it circumscribes a unit of survival. What do you have to do with us? What do we have to do with you? That makes you a unit. When you answer that in the affirmative, there is a connection. There is a unity here. That forms a unity which purpose is to survive and possibly thrive. And so that's the ultimate political question. What's in it? What's in and what's out? What is it that we wrestle with and do politics with? That we work out a way of trying to figure out how we survive as a unit? Now, that's reinforced by the second question. Have you come to destroy us? Because those who destroy us are enemies. Enemies aren't people we disagree with. Enemies aren't people who we have unfair relationships with. Enemies aren't people who we have conflicts of interest and antagonism even with. Enemies are people that seek to destroy us. And they pose an ultimate political threat to us as a unit. And so what I think this question that the demon asks is one that is saying, why it indicates a certain amount of divisiveness and a certain amount of dissension and chaos. Actually, the divisiveness and chaos that you would expect of a village of destitute people. There isn't much that ties us together. We're all at it for our own individual survival. And the demon gives voice to that problem, that concern, and that issue. It also asks, implicit way, a question of what is unity? What is it that unites us together, that makes us into a community, that makes us into a politic, a body politic? And we hear a lot these days about unity. Some of it's absolutely off the wall. Some of it I resonate with pretty strongly, but not always entirely sure why. And so when I ask the question, what is unity? The first thing to acknowledge is that I don't really know. I'm not quite sure entirely what it is. That perhaps like pornography, I see it when I recognize it when I see it. And when I recognize it when it's not there, but what exactly does it entail? I'm not quite sure. But there is some things I do know about it. And fundamentally, unity is not humiliating people. And that's the baseline about this stuff. You don't have unity. You don't have a political unity with people with whom you humiliate. And so the basis of humility is non-humiliation. You can engage in it and not be demeaned, not be lowered, not humiliated. But there's more to it than that. And you can ask, what is it that holds us together? What are the bonds that hold us together? Sociologists and anthropologists talk about thick and thin relationships. Thick relationships are those that look into the face of someone. That your relationships is described and circumscribed by that particular person, the relationship that I have with you as a person. It's not the same as the relationship I have with someone else. Thick relationships are about what I owe you and not anyone else, by virtue of the relationship that I have with you. I owe my kids something that I don't owe other folks. I owe my spouse something that I don't owe other folks. I know my neighbors, I owe them too as well. And so I have to know what is it that I owe and engaged with someone by virtue of the fact of who they are. And that's called a thick relationship. A thin relationship is when you just take any human being and put it in there. I owe you this by virtue of the fact that you're a human being. You could take anyone and switch them out, and the obligations and duties and responsibilities I have for you are the same, simply by the fact that you are a human being. My friend Avishai Margalit, who is a moral philosopher, says that we owe people in thick relationships care and concern. We owe people in thin relationships respect, respect that they are a human being. In the course of the time that I will talk to you, 60 to 70 people in the United States will die of COVID. Now, am I crushed by that? No. I'm not nearly as crushed by it as I would be if it were one of my kids or my spouse or some of my neighbors. But I care. I owe them respect as a human being. And that's what the distinction is. Now, if you ask where do relationships that make up a country or a nation exist, and they exist part way in between these two things. And they pertain of what Avishai calls shoulder-to-shoulder relationships or solidarity. I'm not looking into everyone's face, but I'm standing shoulder to shoulder looking to a future that we could build. And that future is built upon what we call a shared future, which I'm going to get to in a minute. If you think about what is it that composes those, it has to do with the bonds. It has to do with interests, that we share common interests. We think of it as encapsulated interests, that our interests are linked together in such a way that as we pursue them, we further each other's interests, that a political unit has to have that commonality of interest, either by naturally or by construction. But it also has to do with sentiments. What do we feel about one another? And strong political relationships are described by tolerance, trust, understanding. Now ask the question, how much does that exist in our country today? And I think precious little, that we're at the breaking point where that unit of survival comes apart, where people look at each other and say, my survival is not tied to you. I want to go it alone and separate from you. And it happens on both sides of what we think of as the political divide. And I think it's a very serious challenge and task that we face. Some of you, well, I've actually been involved in this congregation since 1976. And I have, for the last 15 years or so, been deeply involved in early church. And I haven't been so much in what is this 10 o'clock service. And so when I do attend and look around, there are a lot of people that I barely know. There's some that I don't know. I don't know who you are. And so where I feel a loss at that, I also feel that, right, I mean, for this sermon at this time, you need to know something about me. And that is that before I retired at Stanford, I led a project that looked at what was the relationships of grassroots dialogue to political and social reconciliation in Northern Ireland. And what we discovered in that was that it wasn't that agreements made for peaceful relationship or even agreement for peaceful relationship, but peaceful relationships make agreement possible. And so the question we had to ask is, what is it that gives shape to peaceful relationships? And we found four questions were central to that. One was the question of a shared future. One was the question of trustworthiness. One was the question of loss acceptance. And one was the question of just entitlements. Notice that I say they're questions, not answers. They are the questions that you have to address with one another every day. There may not be a final answer to those questions, but it is the conversation and discussion of those questions that give shape to the kind of relationships that make peaceful possible. And we engage those questions every day. I don't think peace is some kind of stable set that when you take certain things and mess it up away, you get it back. No, I think you construct peace daily in the actions and the conversations and in the attitudes that you bring to an encounter. But the key one in those four questions is the vision of a shared future. Now, vision of a shared future begins with disagreement. It doesn't start. Many people say, well, we'll tell you what we agree about, and that's the foundation for peace. It's not. A vision of a shared future begins with disagreement, but it asks, am I offering you a vision of the future that you could live with, that you could tolerate, that you could bear? It doesn't have to be exactly what you want. You may even engage it with grit teeth, but you wouldn't use violence to overturn that future if it were to come about. And vice versa, do I see in your vision a place for me that I could live and tolerate? And that sets the boundary, that sets the unit of survival, that sets the context for politics to occur. Because I can engage in politics and lose, absolutely, and still have a future that I could bear. And that's what makes us able to reach agreements, to do politics with one another. And it is what's really at stake here and what's being challenged. I look around and say, are those on the other side of the divide who oppose me? Are they offering me a future that I could bear? And I'm not sure that they are. At the same time, I'm not offering them one either, and I'm sure about that. And so I don't know how to really come at that, but I think it is the problem that we have to engage today. What does it mean to share a future with those with whom we disagree? How do we get along as a unit of survival with those who disagree? Well, that's a pretty difficult question and a difficult problem, and one that we need to spend a lot of time trying to answer if we want the unit of political survival to be the United States. That's what it is that we face. We can no longer really do politics. I saw in Northern Ireland, in the times that I did, the results, not the beginning, but the results of breaking that. And I saw how hard it was to put it back together once it was broken. There was a guy that I know who's my campus minister, I mean, actually campus minister, my youth minister in Eufaula, who went on to be the pastor of a church, an African-American church in Kansas City. He was the only white member of that church, but he was their pastor and was very effective. He bought a farm. And on that farm, he went out to get it, and there was a tractor there, and the guy who was selling it to him looked at the tractor and said, "Sam, the mainest thing is don't bust nothing, because it takes so hard to fix what's busted." And that's what I feel where we are right now, that it's really important. We don't bust nothing, because it's going to take a lot to try to put that back together. So I ask us to look at that. How much does that vision of a shared future allow us to engage with one another in tolerance, in trust, and in understanding? And I think it is the foundation for those things. And somehow or another, we have to recapture that today. I think it's important that the demon asked that question, because it's reflective of the context in which he lived. It was what possessed him and put him in a bad mood. That there was chaos and dissension. There was distance and disagreement. It was a mess, and I'm in the middle of it, and I'm caught in it, and I'm gripped by it. And I look to Jesus to dispel it. This passage presents us with an invitation and a challenge. The invitation is contained in the teachings of Jesus, which everyone marveled at. The passage does not say they marveled at his personality. They marveled at him. He was the Son of God, and he came in, and boy, it changed everything. It was in his teachings that they were saved. They were redeemed. They were empowered. They were given the ability to act. And so it presents us with a challenge, because we know from the rest of the gospel that what Jesus did was make an invitation, an offer, to live a life that is structured by agape, to live a life that is opened by agape, and to live a life that is open to agape. That's the invitation. And the challenge is, well, quite frankly, do you believe it? Do you really think that a life structured by agape, open to agape, enabled by agape, can really overcome those divisions in Capernaum and in the United States today? It seems like it won't, but then it's maybe all that we have. And maybe it comes to us with an authority that enables. But it only comes there when we embrace it by faith. And by faith, I don't mean a set of beliefs. I mean trust. Philosophers talk about there is belief in and belief that. I believe that certain things are such. I believe in things like the Constitution, and in particular, the faith of Jesus. And so it is a question and a matter of faith. Do you believe it? Do you trust it? And we stand before that this day and the challenges that we face. My brothers and sisters, there is a bad moon rising. There is a very bad moon rising. And we have to find the courage and the dedication and the commitment to meet it. Yes, yes, my brothers and sisters, we can do that together. We have to do it together. But it is nevertheless the challenge of, do we believe that in agape, I am brought back. I am redeemed to be a child of God. Well, my brothers and sisters, amen. And I look forward to joining you in that challenge, as well as responding to that invitation.